The subject of these readings is the yoga known as Raja Yoga. The highest authority on Raja Yoga is Patanjali's aphorisms, which form its textbook. Other Indian philosophers, though occasionally differing from Patanjali in some philosophical points, have as a rule acceded to his method of practice. The subject of our talks consists of Vivekananda's rather free translation of the aphorisms of Patanjali and Vivekananda's commentary on them. Effort has been made to avoid technicalities as far as possible and keep to the free and easy style of conversation. Fortunately, there is a first-hand account of how Raja Yoga came to be written. In 1895, Vivekananda dictated the content of this work to Sarah Ellen Waldo, who later described their work sessions. She wrote, "It was inspiring to see the Swami as he dictated to me the contents of the work. In delivering his commentaries on the sutras or aphorisms, he would leave me waiting while he entered deep states of meditation or self-contemplation to emerge therefrom with some luminous interpretation. I had always to keep the pen dipped in the ink. He might be absorbed for long periods of time, and then suddenly his silence would be broken by some eager expression or some long, deliberate teaching." In his introduction to this subject, Vivekananda said, "The science of Raja Yoga proposes to put before humanity a practical and scientifically worked out method of reaching truth. In the first place, every science must have its own method of investigation. If you want to become an astronomer and sit down and cry, 'Astronomy, astronomy,' it will never come to you. The same with chemistry. A certain method must be followed. You must go to a laboratory, take different substances, mix them up, compound them, experiment with them, and out of that will come a knowledge of chemistry. If you want to be an astronomer, you must go to an observatory, take a telescope, study the stars and planets, and then you'll become an astronomer. Each science must have its own methods. I could preach you thousands of sermons, but they would not make you religious until you practiced the method. These are the truths of the sages of all countries, of all ages, of men pure and unselfish, who had no motive but to do good to the world. They all declare that they have found some truth higher than what the senses can bring to us, and they invite verification. They ask us to take up the method and practice honestly, and then, if we do not find this higher truth, we will have the right to say there is no truth in the claim. But before we have done that, we are not rational in denying the truth of their assertions. So we must work faithfully, using the prescribed methods, and light will come. In acquiring knowledge, we make use of generalization, and generalization is based upon observation. We first observe facts, then generalize, and then draw conclusions or principles. The knowledge of the mind, of the internal nature of man, of thought, can never be had until we have first the power of observing the facts that are going on within. It is comparatively easy to observe facts in the external world, for many instruments have been invented for the purpose, but in the internal world we have no instrument to help us. Yet we know we must observe in order to have a real science. Without a proper analysis, any science will be hopeless, mere theorizing. And that is why all the psychologists have been quarreling among themselves since the beginning of time, except those few who found out the means of observation. The science of Raja Yoga proposes to give us a means of observing the internal states. The instrument is the mind itself. The power of attention, when properly guided and directed towards the internal world, will analyze the mind and illumine facts for us. The powers of the mind are like rays of light dissipated. When they are concentrated, they illumine. This is our only means of knowledge. Everyone is using it, both in the external and the internal world. But for the psychologist, the same minute observation has to be directed to the internal world, which the scientific man directs to the external. And this requires a great deal of practice. From our childhood upwards, we have been taught only to pay attention to things external, but never to things internal. Hence, most of us have nearly lost the faculty of observing the internal mechanism. To turn the mind, as it were, inside, stop it from going outside, and then to concentrate all its powers and throw them upon the mind itself in order that it may know its own nature, analyze itself, is very hard work. Yet, that is the only way to anything which will be a scientific approach to the subject. What is the use of such knowledge? In the first place, knowledge itself is the highest reward of knowledge. And secondly, there is also utility in it. It will take away all our misery when, by analyzing his own mind, man comes face to face, as it were, with something which is never destroyed, something which is, by its own nature, eternally pure and perfect. He will no more be miserable, no more unhappy. All misery comes from fear, from unsatisfied desire. Man will find that he never dies, and then he will have no more fear of death. When he knows that he is perfect, he will have no more vain desires, and both these causes being absent, there will be no more misery. There will be perfect bliss, even while in this body. Chapter 1. Concentration, its spiritual uses. Verse 1. Now, concentration is explained. Verse 2. Yoga is restraining the mind stuff, or chitta, from taking various forms, or vrittis. A good deal of explanation is necessary here. We have to understand what chitta is and what the vrittis are. I have eyes. Eyes do not see. Take away the brain center, which is in the head. The eyes will still be there, the retinae complete, as also the pictures of objects on them, and yet the eyes will not see. So the eyes are only a secondary instrument, not the organ of vision. The organ of vision is in a nerve center of the brain. The two eyes will not be sufficient. Sometimes a man is asleep with his eyes open. The light is there, and the picture is there, but a third thing is necessary. The mind must be joined to the organ. The eye is the external instrument. We need also the brain center and the agency of the mind. Carriages roll down a street and you do not hear them. Why? Because your mind has not attached itself to the organ of hearing. First, there is the instrument. Then, there is the organ. And third, the mind attached to these two. The mind takes the impression farther in and presents it to the determinative faculty, or buddhi, which reacts. Along with this reaction, flashes the idea of egoism. Then this mixture of action and reaction is presented to the purusha, the real soul, who perceives an object in this mixture. The organs, or indriyas, together with the mind, or manas, the determinative faculty, or buddhi, and egoism, or ahamkara, form the group called the antahkarana, the internal instrument. They are but various processes in the mind stuff, called chitta. The waves of thought in the chitta are called vrittis, literally whirlpools. What is thought? Thought is a force, as is gravitation or repulsion. from the infinite storehouse of force in nature, the instrument called chitta takes hold of some, absorbs it, and sends it out as thought. Force is supplied to us through food, and out of that food, the body obtains the power of motion, etc. Others, the finer forces, it throws out in what we call thought. So we see that the mind is not intelligent, yet it appears to be intelligent. Why? Because the intelligent soul is behind it. You are the only sentient being. Mind is only the instrument through which you catch the external world. Take this book. As a book, it does not exist outside. What exists outside is unknown and unknowable. The unknowable furnishes the suggestion that gives a blow to the mind, and the mind gives out the reaction in the form of a book. In the same manner as when a stone is thrown into the water is thrown against it in the form of waves. The real universe is the occasion of the reaction of the mind. A book form, or an elephant form, or a man form, is not outside. All that we know is our mental reaction from the outer suggestion. Matter is the permanent possibility of sensations, said John Stuart Mill. It is only the suggestion that is outside. Take an oyster, for example. You know how pearls are made. A grain of sand gets inside the shell and causes irritation, and the oyster throws a sort of enameling round it, and this makes the pearl. The universe of experience is our own enamel, so to say, and the real universe is the grain of sand serving as nucleus. The ordinary man will never understand it, because when he tries to do so, he throws out an enamel and sees only his own enamel. Now we understand what is meant by these vrittis. The real man is behind the mind. The mind is the instrument in his hands. It is his intelligence that is percolating through the mind. It is only when you stand behind the mind that it becomes intelligent. When man gives it up, it falls to pieces and is nothing. Thus you understand what is meant by chitta. It is the mind stuff, and vrittis are the waves and ripples rising in it when external causes impinge on it. These vrittis are our universe. The bottom of a lake we cannot see because its surface is covered with ripples. It is only possible for us to catch a glimpse of the bottom when the ripples have subsided and the water is calm. If the water is muddy or is agitated all the time, the bottom will not be seen. If it is clear and there are no waves, we shall see the bottom. The bottom of the lake is our own true self. The lake is the chitta and the waves the vrittis. Again, the mind is in three states, one of which is darkness, called tamas, found in brutes and idiots. It only acts to injure. No other idea comes into that state of mind. Then there is the active state of mind, rajas, whose chief motives are power and enjoyment. I will be powerful and rule others. Then there is the state called sattva, serenity, calmness, in which the waves cease and the water of the mind lake becomes clear. It is not inactive, but rather intensely active. It is the greatest manifestation of power to be calm. It is easy to be active. Let the reins go, and the horses will run away with you. Anyone can do that. But he who can stop the plunging horses is the strong man. Which requires the greater strength, letting go or restraining? The calm man is not the man who is dull. You must not mistake sattva for dullness or laziness. The calm man is the one who has control over the mind waves. Activity is the manifestation of inferior strength, calmness of the superior. The chitta is always trying to get back to its natural, pure state, but the organs draw it out. To restrain it, to check this outward tendency, and to start it on the return journey to the essence of intelligence is the first step in yoga, because only in this way can the chitta get into its proper course. Although the chitta is in every animal, from the lowest to the highest, it is only in the human form that we find it as the intellect. Until the mind stuff can take the form of intellect, it is not possible for it to return through all these steps and liberate the soul. Immediate salvation is impossible for the cow or the dog, although they have mind, because their chitta cannot as yet take that form, which we call intellect. The chitta manifests itself in the following forms: scattering, darkening, gathering, one-pointed, and concentrated. The scattering form is activity. Its tendency is to manifest in the form of pleasure or of pain. The darkening form is dullness, which tends to injury. The commentator says, the third form, one-pointed, is natural to the devas, the angels, and the first and second, scattering and darkening, to the demons. The gathering form is when it struggles to center itself. The one-pointed form is when it tries to concentrate, and the concentrated form is what brings us to samadhi. Verse 3. At that time, the time of concentration, the seer or Purusha rests in his own unmodified state. As soon as the waves have stopped and the lake has become quiet, we see its bottom. And so with the mind, when it is calm, we see what our own nature is. We do not mix ourselves but remain our own selves. Verse 4. At other times, other than that of concentration, the seer is identified with the modifications. For instance, someone blames me. This produces a modification, a vritti, in my mind, and I identify myself with it, and the result is misery. Verse 5. There are five classes of modifications, some painful and others not painful. Verse 6. These are right knowledge, indiscrimination, verbal delusion, sleep, and memory. Verse 7. Direct perception, inference, and competent evidence are proofs. When two of our perceptions do not contradict each other, we call it proof. I hear something, and if it contradicts something already perceived, I begin to fight it out and do not believe it. There are also three kinds of proof. Pratyaksha, or direct perception, whatever we see and feel, is proof if there has been nothing to delude the senses. I see the world, that is sufficient proof that it exists. Secondly, anumana, or inference. You see a sign, and from the sign you come to the thing signified. Thirdly, aptavakya, the direct evidence of the yogis, of those who have seen the truth. We are all of us struggling towards knowledge, but you and I have to struggle hard and come to knowledge through a long, tedious process of reasoning. But the yogi, the pure one, has gone beyond all this. Before his mind, the past, the present, and the future are alike, one book for him to read. He does not require to go through the tedious processes for knowledge that we have to. His words are proof, because he sees knowledge in himself. These, for instance, are the authors of the sacred scriptures. therefore the scriptures are proof. If any such persons are living now, their words will be proof. Other philosophers go into long discussions about Aptavakya, and they say, what is the proof of their words? The proof is their direct perception. Because whatever I see is proof, and whatever you see is proof, if it does not contradict any past knowledge. There is knowledge beyond the senses, and whenever it does not contradict reason and past human experience, that knowledge is proof. Any madman may come into this room and say he sees angels around him. That would not be proof. In the first place, it must be true knowledge. And secondly, it must not contradict past knowledge. And thirdly, it must depend upon the character of the man who gives it out. I hear it said that the character of the man is not of so much importance as what he may say. We must first hear what he says. This may be true in other things. A man may be wicked and yet make an astronomical discovery. But in religion it is different, because no impure man will ever have the power to reach the truths of religion. Therefore we have first of all to see that the man who declares himself to be an apta is a perfectly unselfish and holy person. Secondly, that he has reached beyond the senses. And thirdly, that what he says does not contradict the past knowledge of humanity. Any new discovery of truth does not contradict the past truth, but fits into it. And fourthly, that truth must have a possibility of verification. If a man says, I have seen a vision, and tells me that I have no right to see it, I believe him not. Everyone must have the power to see it for himself. No one who sells his knowledge is an apta. All these conditions must be fulfilled. You must first see that the man is pure and that he has no selfish motive, that he has no thirst for gain or fame. Secondly, he must show that he is superconscious. He must give us something that we cannot get from our senses and which is for the benefit of the world. Thirdly, we must see that it does not contradict other truths. If it contradicts other scientific truths, reject it at once. Fourthly, the man should never be singular. He should only represent what all men can attain. The three sorts of proof are then direct sense perception, inference, and the words of an apta. I cannot translate this word into English. It is not the word inspired, because inspiration is believed to come from outside, while this knowledge comes from the man himself. The literal meaning is attained. Verse 8. Indiscrimination is false knowledge not established in real nature. The next class of vrittis that arises is mistaking one thing for another, as a piece of mother of pearl is taken for a piece of silver. Verse 9. Verbal delusion follows from words having no corresponding reality. There is another class of vrittis called vikalpa. A word is uttered and we do not wait to consider its meaning. We jump to a conclusion immediately. It is a sign of weakness of the chitta or mind stuff. Now you can understand the theory of restraint. The weaker the man, the less he has of restraint. Examine yourselves always by that test. When you are going to be angry or miserable, reason it out how it is that some news that has come to you is throwing your mind into vrittis. Verse 10. Sleep is a vritti which embraces the feeling of voidness. The next class of vrittis is called sleep and dream. When we awake, we know that we have been sleeping. We can only have memory of perception. That which we do not perceive, we never can have any memory of. every reaction is a wave in the lake. Now if, during sleep, the mind had no waves, it would have no perceptions, positive or negative, and therefore we would not remember them. The very reason of our remembering sleep is that during sleep there was a certain class of waves in the mind. Memory is another class of vrittis, which is called smriti. Verse 11. Memory is when the vrittis of perceived subjects do not slip away and through impressions come back to consciousness. Memory can come from direct perception, false knowledge, verbal delusion, and sleep. For instance, you hear a word. That word is like a stone thrown into the lake of the citta. It causes a ripple, and that ripple rouses a series of ripples. This is memory. So in sleep, when the peculiar kind of ripple, called sleep, throws the citta into a ripple of memory, it is called a dream. Dream is another form of the ripple, which, in the waking state, is called memory. Verse 12. Their control is by practice and non-attachment. The mind, to have non-attachment, must be clear, good, and rational. Why should we practice? Because each action is like the pulsations quivering over the surface of the lake. The vibration dies out, and what is left? The samskaras, the impressions. When a large number of these impressions are left on the mind, they coalesce and become a habit. It is said, habit is second nature. It is first nature also, and the whole nature of man. Everything that we are is the result of habit. That gives us consolation, because if it is only habit, we can make and unmake it at any time. The samskaras are left by these vibrations, passing out of our mind, each one of them leaving its result. Our character is the sum total of these marks, and according as some particular wave prevails, one takes that tone. If good prevails, one becomes good. If wickedness, one becomes wicked. If joyfulness, one becomes happy. The only remedy for bad habits is counter habits. All the bad habits that have left their impressions are to be controlled by good habits. Go on doing good, thinking holy thoughts continuously. That is the only way to suppress base impressions. Never say any man is hopeless, because he only represents a character, a bundle of habits, which can be checked by new and better ones. Character is repeated habits, and repeated habits alone can reform character. Verse 13. Continuous struggle to keep them, the vrittis, perfectly restrained, is practice. What is practice? It is the attempt to restrain the mind in citta form, to prevent its going out into waves. Verse 14. It becomes firmly grounded by long, constant efforts with great love for the end to be obtained. Restraint does not come in one day, but by long and continued practice. Verse 15. That effect which comes to those who have given up their thirst after objects, either seen or heard, and which wills to control the objects, is non-attachment. The two motive powers of our actions are one, what we see ourselves, and two, the experience of others. These two forces throw the mind, the lake, into various waves. Renunciation is the power of battling against these forces and holding the mind in check. Their renunciation is what we want. I am passing through a street, and a man comes and takes away my watch. That is my own experience. I see it myself, and it immediately throws my chitta into a wave, taking the form of anger. Allow not that to come. If you cannot prevent that, you are nothing. If you can, you have vairagya, non-attachment. Again, the experience of the worldly-minded teaches us that sense enjoyments are the highest ideal. These are tremendous temptations. To deny them and not allow the mind to come to a wave form with regard to them is renunciation. To control the twofold motive powers arising from my own experience and from the experience of others, and thus prevent the chitta from being governed by them, is vairagya. These should be controlled by me, and not I by them. This sort of mental strength is called renunciation. Vairagya is the only way to freedom. Verse 16. That is extreme non-attachment, which gives up even the qualities, and comes from the knowledge of the real nature of the Purusha, or soul. It is the highest manifestation of the power of vairagya when it takes away even our attraction towards the qualities. We have first to understand what the Purusha, the self, is and what the qualities are. According to yoga philosophy, the whole of nature consists of three qualities or forces. One is called tamas, another rajas, and the third sattva. These three qualities manifest themselves in the physical world as darkness or inactivity, attraction or repulsion, and equilibrium of the two. Everything that is in nature, all manifestations, are combinations and recombinations of these three forces. Nature has been divided into various categories by the Samkhyas. The self of man is beyond all these, beyond nature. It is effulgent, pure, and perfect. Whatever of intelligence we see in nature is but the reflection of this self upon nature. Nature itself is insentient. You must remember that the word nature also includes the mind. Mind is in nature. Thought is in nature. From thought down to the grossest form of matter, everything is in nature, the manifestation of nature. This nature has covered the self of man, and when nature takes away the covering, the self appears in its own glory. The non-attachment, as described in aphorism 15, as being control of objects or nature, is the greatest help towards manifesting the self. The next aphorism defines samadhi, perfect concentration, which is the goal of the yogi. Verse 17. The concentration, called right knowledge, is that which is followed by reasoning, discrimination, bliss, and unqualified egoism. Samadhi is divided into two varieties. One is called the sampragnyata and the other the asampragnyata. In the sampragnyata samadhi come all the powers of controlling nature. It is of four varieties. The first variety is called the savitarka, when the mind meditates upon an object again and again by isolating it from other objects. There are two sorts of objects for meditation in the 25 categories of the Samkhyas. One, the 24 insentient categories of nature, and two, the one sentient Purusha. This part of yoga is based entirely on Samkhya philosophy, about which I've already told you. As you will remember, egoism and will and mind have a common basis, the chitta or the mind stuff, out of which they are all manufactured. The mind stuff takes in the forces of nature and projects them as thought. There must be something, again, where both force and matter are one. This is called avyakta, the unmanifested state of nature before creation, and to which, after the end of a cycle, the whole of nature returns to come out again after another period. Beyond that is the Purusha, the essence of intelligence. Knowledge is power, and as soon as we begin to know a thing, we get power over it. So also when the mind begins to meditate on the different elements, it gains power over them. That sort of meditation, where the external gross elements are the objects, is called savitarka. Vitarka means question. Savitarka, with question, questioning the elements, as it were, that they may give their truths and their powers to the man who meditates upon them. There is no liberation in getting powers. It is a worldly search after enjoyments, and there is no enjoyment in this life. All search for enjoyment is vain. This is the old, old lesson which man finds so hard to learn. When he does learn it, he gets out of the universe and becomes free. The possession of what are called occult powers is only intensifying the world and, in the end, intensifying suffering. Though as a scientist, Patanjali is bound to point out the possibilities of this science, he never misses an opportunity to warn us against these powers. Again, in the very same meditation, when one struggles to take the elements out of time and space, and think of them as they are, it is called nirvitarka, without question. When the meditation goes a step higher and takes the tanmatras as its object and thinks of them as in time and space, it is called savichara, with discrimination. And when, in the same meditation, one eliminates time and space and thinks of the fine elements as they are, it is called nirvichara, without discrimination. The next step is when the elements are given up, both gross and fine, and the object of meditation is the interior organ, the thinking organ. When the thinking organ is thought of as bereft of the qualities of activity and dullness, it is then called sananda, the blissful samadhi. When the mind itself is the object of meditation, when meditation becomes very ripe and concentrated, when all ideas of the gross and fine materials are given up, when the sattva state only of the ego remains, but differentiated from all other objects, it is called sasmita samadhi. The man who has attained to this has attained to what is called in the Vedas bereft of body. He can think of himself as without his gross body, but he will have to think of himself as with a fine body. Those that in this state get merged in nature without attaining the goal are called prakritilayas, but those who do not stop even there reach the goal, which is freedom. Verse 18. There is another samadhi which is attained by the constant practice of cessation of all mental activity, in which the chitta retains only the unmanifested impressions. This is the perfect, superconscious, asamprajnata samadhi, the state which gives us freedom. The first state does not give us freedom, does not liberate the soul. A man may attain to all powers and yet fall again. There is no safeguard until the soul goes beyond nature. It is very difficult to do so, although the method seems easy. The method is to meditate on the mind itself, and whenever thought comes, to strike it down, allowing no thought to come into the mind, thus making it an entire vacuum. When we can really do this, that very moment we shall attain liberation. When persons without training and preparation try to make their minds vacant, they are likely to succeed only in covering themselves with tamas, the material of ignorance, which makes the mind dull and stupid, and leads them to think that they are making a vacuum of the mind. To be able to really do that is to manifest the greatest strength, the highest control. When this state, asampragnata, superconsciousness, is reached, the samadhi becomes seedless. What is meant by that? In a concentration where there is consciousness, where the mind succeeds only in quelling the waves in the chitta and holding them down, the waves remain in the form of tendencies. These tendencies, or seeds, become waves again when the time comes. But when you have destroyed all these tendencies, almost destroyed the mind, then the samadhi becomes seedless. There are no more seeds in the mind out of which to manufacture again and again this plant of life, this ceaseless round of birth and death. You may ask, what state would that be in which there is no mind, there is no knowledge? What we call knowledge is a lower state than the one beyond knowledge. You must always bear in mind that the extremes look very much alike. If a very low vibration of ether is taken as darkness, an intermediate state is light. Very high vibration will be darkness again. Similarly, ignorance is the lowest state. Knowledge is the middle state, and beyond knowledge is the highest state, the two extremes of which seem the same. Knowledge itself is a manufactured something, a combination. It is not reality. What is the result of constant practice of this higher concentration? All old tendencies of restlessness and dullness will be destroyed, as well as the tendencies of goodness too. The case is similar to that of the chemicals used to take the dirt and alloy off gold. When the ore is smelted down, the dross is burnt along with the chemicals. So this constant controlling power will stop the previous bad tendencies and eventually the good ones also. Those good and evil tendencies will suppress each other, leaving alone the soul in its own splendor, untrammeled by either good or bad, the omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient. Then the man will know that he had neither birth nor death, nor need for heaven or earth. He will know that he neither came nor went. It was nature which was moving, and that movement was reflected upon the soul. The form of the light reflected by the glass upon the wall moves, and the wall foolishly thinks it is moving. So with all of us. It is the chitta, the mind stuff, constantly moving, making itself into various forms, and we think that we are these various forms. All these delusions will vanish. When that free soul will command, not pray or beg, but command, then whatever it desires will be immediately fulfilled. Whatever it wants, it will be able to do. According to the Samkhya philosophy, there is no God. It says that there can be no God of this universe. Because if there were one, he must be a soul, and a soul must be either bound or free. How can the soul that is bound by nature, or controlled by nature, create? It is itself a slave. On the other hand, why should the soul that is free create and manipulate all these things? It has no desires, so it cannot have any need to create. Secondly, it says the theory of God is an unnecessary one. Nature explains all. What is the use of any God? But Kapila teaches that there are many souls who, though nearly attaining perfection, fall short because they cannot perfectly renounce all powers. Their minds, for a time, merge in nature to re-emerge as its masters. Such gods there are. We shall all become such gods, and, according to the Samkhyas, the god spoken of in the Vedas really means one of these free souls. Beyond them, there is not an eternally free and blessed creator of the universe. On the other hand, the yogis say, not so, there is a god. There is one soul, separate from all other souls, and he is the eternal master of all creation, the ever-free, the teacher of all teachers. The yogis admit that those whom the Samkhyas call the merged in nature also exist. They are yogis who have fallen short of perfection, and though for a time debarred from attaining the goal, remain as rulers of part of the universe.